We always have so many things to tell our audience about here at Intelligence Squared. So when I'm needing a top-down view of it all, I don't want to feel like I'm looking at organized chaos. That's why I really love Notion, which lays out different threads of work in a beautifully designed layout. And despite all of its clever AI tech going on in the background, it feels as clear and easy as putting pen to paper. Remember that? But with Notion, you can do a lot more than jot down a few thoughts. Notion is a place where any team can write, plan, organize, and rediscover the joy of play. And thanks to its AI-powered model, the way it works is so intuitive, every question has an answer. I still love my paper notebook, but sitting next to Notion, it might need to up its game a little bit. Try Notion for free and up your game too when you go to notion.com/squared. That's all lowercase letters, notion.com/squared, lowercase. So you can start turning ideas into action. And when you use the link, you're supporting Intelligence Squared too. That's notion.com/squared.
This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
You're listening to Intelligence Squared. Today we're speaking to Yale professor and author Paul Bloom about the sweet spot of pain, pleasure and suffering. Here's economist and broadcaster Linda Yu with more.
Thank you all for joining us, and I'm delighted to welcome Yale professor Paul Bloom, who's here to discuss his fantastic new book, The Sweet Spot. We'll be discussing finding the sweet spot of pain, pleasure, and suffering. He is the Brooks and Suzanne Reagan Professor of Psychology and Cognitive Science at Yale University. In this book, Paul addresses questions such as, why do some people like horror movies? Does unchosen suffering, say the death of a child, make us more resilient? What will doubling your salary do to your happiness? And why do we so often seek out pain and emotional turmoil? And there's many more such questions in this book. Welcome, Paul. So first, let me just ask you, what is the sweet spot? And why did you want to write about it in this book?
Thanks, Linda. It's great to be talking with you. I got into this book because I was interested in certain puzzles, strange appetites people have. You know, we like spicy foods or hot baths. Some of us go to scary movies. Some of us listen to songs that make us weep. Some people enjoy BDSM. Everybody enjoys some sort of pain. And I was really interested in why. And so I was going to write a book on that called The Pleasures of Suffering or Pleasures of Pain. But as I wrote it and started to write and started to read what other people were talking about, I realized that there's another reason why we seek out suffering and pain and difficulty that's not for the purpose of pleasure, but for higher goals, like leading a meaningful life or connection, or spiritual reasons or moral reasons. And my book says a lot of things, but one of the things is a defense of what I could call motivational pluralism, which is humans have many, many different appetites. And one of the projects of being a person then is figuring out how to put them in the right balance and to find a sweet spot between pleasure and meaning and morality. And that's kind of how the book got the title. It also just seemed like a nice, I like the phrase. It seems to come up over and over again.
You almost chose the book title, The Pleasures of Suffering, but why did you decide otherwise? Perhaps book sales?
I like The Pleasures of Suffering. The problem with it was incomplete. So it's true, a lot of the suffering we do is for the purpose of pleasure. That's what BDSM is all about. It's people enjoy. That's what people go to scary movies. They enjoy
just define
it.
Define BDSM for us.
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm sorry. And there may be a sort of language difference here. It's sadomasochistic behavior, sadomasochistic sex. It includes everything from heavy duty sadomasochism, the experience of real pain, but it also includes reading a book like 50 Shades of Grey. Or watching more like 50 Shades of Grey, where you enjoy it vicariously. And so that was that. So, and that's all pleasure. But then I started thinking about other things like training for a marathon or starting a business, writing a book, raising children. I find raising children is for me a wonderful example of something which people do. They usually don't regret it. They say it's of tremendous significance, but it's hard. It involves anxiety and struggle and difficulty. People know it's going to be hard. And I think The difficulty is part and parcel why it's so valuable. But I wouldn't call that pleasure in any simple sense.
Mm. And you write that the idea we hope to make it through life unscathed is not quite complete as a theory of a good life. So in the book, you write that under the right circumstances and in the right doses, physical and emotional pain, difficulty, failure, and loss are exactly what we're looking for. So tell me why you write that nobody is immune to the lure of suffering.
So the last part is an empirical observation of the world. I've never met somebody who one way or another didn't seek out pain. Yeah, and it differs. Your mileage may vary. Some people like to run. Others like to go to movies that make them scream, that just terrify them, very upsetting. Some like to indulge in masochistic fantasies of what happens when their life goes badly. Some people, you know, train for difficult physical pursuits. They go on long, they travel to difficult places. They go camping, you know, giving up hot showers and everything. And for all of these things, the people say, yeah, I know it hurts. I know this is going to be hard, but that's part and parcel of what makes it important.
You write about two forms of chosen suffering. So you mentioned there the experience of a marathon that gives pleasure. And secondly, the part that is also, I think, probably not discussed as much is that something like a marathon could be part of a life well lived. So just tell me about the importance of chosen suffering for something like that.
That's right. And it's an important thing to talk about right away. I wrote in the Wall Street Journal a summary of my book a couple of weeks back. And right away, I got a very angry letter from somebody who says, I live my whole life in chronic pain, the terrible pain. Who are you to tell me this is valuable? What do you know? And I pointed out, you're right. I'm not saying that bad stuff that happens to you is something we should welcome. Chronic pain, the death of a child, a violent assault. That's bad stuff which happens to people. And I think we could talk about how resilient people are and the stories people tell. But that's not what I'm arguing for. I'm arguing for the suffering we choose. And the suffering we choose could come in roughly two flavors, though there's cases which sort of overlap. So one flavor is we really seek out the suffering. We seek out the pain. You know, so I'm going to eat some really spicy food. And I know it's hot. I know it's going to burn my mouth and make me sweat and make me gasp, but I like it. I'm going to go to a hot bath that's really going to fry me up, a sauna or whatever. But we see a payoff at the end. We see some pleasure at the end. So that's one sort. A second sort is a bit more complicated. Somebody might say, look, I want to train for a marathon. I'm out of shape. I want to train for a marathon. When you say that, you're not looking forward to blisters. You're not looking forward to muscle aches and disappointment and maybe failure. But if you didn't know it was difficult, if it wasn't hard, it would have no value to you. So it's not that we say, I want to do really unpleasant, difficult experiences. Rather, some of the time it's, I want to do things which are meaningful and important. And I know those involve difficult experiences.
So tell me more about benign masochism, a term that you use in the book.
It's a lovely term thought up by Paul Rozin. And the benign part is important. These are not cases where people mutilate themselves or give themselves excruciating agony. It's little things. It's, you know, you have a sprained ankle and you press on it a bit. You have a sore tooth and you poke it with your tongue. You listen to a song, there's a really sad song, and you're kind of in a bad mood, and you listen to it. Adele always does it for me, and you kind of get a little bit of sadness. You sulk. You nurture old worlds. You, through choice, you put yourself in a bad space, either physically or emotionally. A large part of my book, the sort of first half, says, what's up with this? Why are we doing this? And I think there's different explanations, one of which is contrast. This is the simplest one, which is sometimes we play with pain to give ourselves greater pleasure in the future. You might put some really spicy foods in your mouth, and then you drink some cool beer and you feel great. You might go into a hot sauna, then dive into a cool lake. You might see a movie where all these terrible things happen, but then the hero gets revenge at the end and all is good. And so we play with contrast. So that's one thing going on in benign masochism. Another thing, just to put it on the table, is that we like to sometimes escape from ourselves, escape from our consciousness. Sometimes being a person with our self-consciousness and our guilt and our shame and our worries and all that is oppressive. Certain sharp experiences pull us away from this. You know, I tell in my book, the first time I ever did a Brazilian jiu-jitsu and I was sparring, I was rolling with somebody, and this person was much stronger and much younger than me, like everyone else in the gym. And for 3 minutes, he basically repeatedly tried to pull my head off of my body and twist my arms off. And in some way, it was painful and difficult and kind of scary. But I realized afterwards that during that time, I thought of nothing else. My mind was clear. I wasn't thinking, how am I looking? I hope my kids are okay. And some things like sadomasochism, rigorous exercise, intense focus will do that. You'll lose yourself. And there's a lot to be said about that.
Mm-hmm. I want to explore some of this in our discussion about the story of the Twilight Zone episode that captures this idea that this omnipotence is boring.
Yeah, I saw this when I was a kid, original Twilight Zone. And and I think there's a real wisdom in it. The story is there's a terrible mobster and he dies and he wakes up and he's in a lovely hotel room, you know, beautiful view of the river. And he discovers, and he has an angel guide, and the guide says, you can do whatever you want. And the guy says, wow, I didn't expect this when I died. I thought I was a bad person. And says, yeah. So he gets all the sex he wants and the power, and he buys stuff and everything comes to him easy. He plays poker with his buddies and wins everything again and again and again. And he starts to go crazy and he says, this is horrible. And he finally says to the guide, I have enough of heaven. I want to go to the other place. And the guide says, why do you think this is heaven? This is the other place. And one version of hell would be you get what you want all the time, and it would strip every activity of joy. And it's complicated. You and I decide to play poker together. I'm looking forward to it, and I don't want to lose. I want to win. You want to win. But if we knew we were going to win, we wouldn't even bother playing. Too boring. The idea of risk and anxiety and a possibility of loss is just integral to these sort of activities.
So tell me about how the brain grades on a curve. So, and that means the secret to happiness may be unhappiness, as you set out in your book.
So this goes back to the idea of contrast. We don't process experiences in terms of absolutes. You know, the temperature water feels like when you stick your hand into a bath depends a lot on what the air temperature is and what temperature it used to be. You know, something, and it's the same with experiences like pain and pleasure. So something, and they've done laboratory experiments, and something that's kind of mildly unpleasant, if you were expecting it to be much worse, could actually feel pleasant. And it's true more abstractly. You lose $10 in a game, and that's pretty bad. But if you thought you're going to lose $100, that's good news. And so we play with contrast. And one of the ways we play with this is if you have some negative experiences, and then you have sort of a neutral experience coming right afterwards. The neutral gets boosted by the comparison with the negative. And I think we play with this a lot in sort of putting ourselves in mild, painful experiences or difficult experiences for the release. It all breaks down to the silly joke my dad told me when I was a kid about the guy who bangs his head against the wall. And he said, why are you doing that? And he says, it feels so good when I stop. And, you know, it's a dumb joke, but to some extent, we do some of this in our everyday life. And, you know, there's all sorts of things that go on, for instance, when we choose to go for a lengthy hike or camping. There's a feeling of mastery, there's connection with nature. But also there's the fact that when it's over, we feel so good. And we look back and say, look what I did. Thank goodness this is in the past, but look what I did. I feel great about it.
So staying on the theme of happiness, for experienced happiness, you cite a study that shows that money matters only up to about $89,000. So that's about 66,000 pounds. But when it comes to life satisfaction, there's no leveling off. So tell me about this contrast.
Yeah, this is some work by Danny Kahneman, brilliant psychologist who won the Nobel Prize for it. And he points out that when we talk about happiness, everybody says, I want to be happy. But happiness means at least to one of two things. One thing is your experienced happiness. Like, so I give you an iPhone app, and then it beeps every once in a while. And then when it beeps, you say how happy you are. And like, oh, I'm 8 out of 10. I'm 7 out of 10. I'm 9 out of 10. And then I could figure out how happy you are on average for your whole life. And that's your experience happiness. Another way, though, is I could ask you, Linda, how happy are you? Just take a few minutes and think, a scale of 1 to 10, or how good is your life? Give me the answer. Just think about things. And these answers correlate, but they're kind of different. One answer is your day-to-day pleasures, the first one. The second answer is your contemplative feeling about how well your life is going. And we could argue, and I think that's a very good argument, have which one should we try to maximize. But there's been studies about the relationship of money to these. And the argument is that day-to-day pleasures, money makes people happier. If anybody ever told you the opposite, they're wrong. Money is a great predictor of happiness of any sort. Richer people are happier than poorer people. Richer countries have happier citizens than poorer countries. And it's not a surprise. Money buys you, health, access to healthcare. It buys you safety. It buys you good schooling for your kids, freedom from exploitation, time with your friends, and, cool stuff. But for experience, it kind of, at a certain point, it doesn't matter if you have more. The original study said about $80,000 American. It's done a little while ago. Let's say, 100,000 pounds or something. But for your reflective, remembered happiness, the sky is the limit. There's diminishing returns. And so you wonder, what's the difference? And one answer is status. So if I say, Linda, how's your life going? One of the things you first think, like, okay, am I well fed? Am I safe? Am I sick? How are the people I love doing? But then you also say, how am I doing relative to everybody else? And if you say, I'm making a lot more money than this guy I'm talking to, that's pretty good. And then that boosts up your happiness. We get very status oriented and comparative.
It's absolutely fascinating. I think there's quite a lot of happiness as a relative concept. Keeping up with the Joneses yes. tends to make you a bit unhappy. And so I can see questions beginning to come in. Please do continue to submit them. And we will get to those up very shortly. But before we do, Paul, I want to talk to you about meaning. So before yes. we go into some of the concepts in your book, I just have one question for you. Okay. Is it the case that everyone over the age of 40 has a midlife crisis?
No, I wouldn't think so. Why? Why do you ask?
So
have
meaning.
Have people been talking about me?
Well, when people talk about meaning, I think that's, when you start thinking about those questions.
Yes.
So I think that's where that occurred to me. So you relay a study in the book where people were asked, are you a giver or a taker?
Yeah.
Givers have more meaning in their lives, but takers have more happiness. So what yes. do the responses yes. mean?
It's really interesting. And it goes back to the idea of pluralism, that there's more than one way to live your life. There's more than one thing to focus on. And some of it, I don't want to be too glib about answering your midlife crisis question. David Brooks has a very interesting book called The Second Mountain, where he points out for a lot of people, and this is not cross-cultural. This is kind of something, in Western countries. But I think it's just a group of people there. But sometimes people say they strive for pleasures, for happiness. Then they get to a certain point and they say, well, okay, let me go for something deeper now, something more, you go from the sort of virtues that you'd want on your CV, on your resume, to the virtues you want in your eulogy when you're dead and people talking to you. And to get a sense of this, of the different priorities people have, there's a lovely study by Roy Baumeister and his colleagues. And what they did was they asked people a bunch of different questions. And one question they asked people was like, how happy are you? Standard question. Other question is, how much meaning do you have in your life? How meaningful is your life? Now, one thing I always have to stress here is these answers are correlated. So you have a lot of people which are high in one and zero in the other, but they tend to go together. So if you tell me you have a meaningful life, you could just also have a happy life. But now let's look at people who go for one versus the other. And you're exactly right. People, there's a kind of a different profile. Happiness is associated with good health, with money, and associated with a relatively easy life. low stress, low anxiety, low difficulty. Meaning is less associated with happiness, less associated with money, and some studies negatively associated with money, and also associated with difficulty and struggle and interacting with people and maybe helping people, but it's hard. And this shows up all over the place. There was a study of 2 million people looking at the jobs they had and asking, how meaningful is your job? And it turns out the jobs that are most meaningful, number one, was being a member of the clergy, being a minister or a priest or rabbi, whatever, social worker, educator, being a member of the military, medical professional. And a lot of these jobs on the top of the list, most meaningful, they don't pay well, they're low status, and they're tough. But they're meaningful. And there's a lot of other jobs which I think have a lot of pleasure, give you a lot of money, but they do lack meaning.
And you write about suffering as a part of meaning in the book. So you talk about the movie The Matrix. I have to say, I've watched The Matrix. I and the computer designed world. Tell us that story and why that captures this so well for you. Because after reading your book, I now get that scene.
Well, I tell a story. I tell an origin story that was told in The Matrix. If you haven't seen the movie, just skip over this part. But where Agent Smith is explaining to Morpheus.
Oh, Morpheus, that's right.
And I think it's Morpheus, how the world came to be. And because the idea is the world is a computer simulation that most of us live in. This is the story of the Matrix, the classic philosophical story that they drew from. He said, we once tried to make you a paradise, that every need was satisfied. And it broke. You didn't survive. You need suffering and pain. You need struggle, or else it doesn't work. And I like the Matrix story. Can I tell one other quick story? It's not from me. It's from Alan Watts, the guy who brought a Zen to the West. And he tells this story of you go to sleep and you find yourself having a lucid dream. You could dream whatever you want. Says for 90 years of experience, whatever you want. And he said, you would have the best time ever. Sex and love and adventure and great food and parties and everything like that. And then you wake up, you live your day, and then you go to sleep again. And there again, you have another, 90 years. He says, you wouldn't do the same thing over again. You say, well, let's make things difficult. Let's throw some failure. Let's do it. Well, sometimes you try something, you lose. Sometimes you think it's easy, it's going to be hard. You wouldn't struggle and difficulty and complexity. And then the punchline is, he says, maybe this is the world you're living now. This world that contains all of these. You think you may want the first world, but this is the world you want and this is the world you have.
Yeah, no, that's a great story that you have in the book. In fact, you have so many great stories in the book. I'm glad that you were able to discuss that one. You also have some fantastic quotes, and I'm going to quote your book where you quote U.S. Supreme Court Chief Justice John Roberts' speech, where he says, and this is his commencement speech at graduation at a university. So in his speech, he said, I wish you bad luck. Again, from time to time, so that you will be conscious of the role of chance in life and understand that your success is not completely deserved and that the failure of others is not completely deserved either. So tell me about this quote. And I think in your chapter on suffering, you do make a distinction between the chosen suffering that we discussed before. So be great to come back to that and think about the speech and what we've been discussing.
I think you're right. I think there's a great big difference between the theme of my book, which is the suffering we choose and how this gives both pleasure and meaning, and bad stuff that happens to us, the stuff that John Roberts is talking about. And I quote him, and I quote him with respect. It's a nice summary of an idea. I'm not sure he's right. I'm not sure. There's some data suggesting that people who have experienced no suffering at all, no bad things has ever happened to them. Sometimes people make it to the age of 30, 40, and they're unscathed. They've never been assaulted. Nobody they love has died. They've never had a failure of any sort. And those people, there's some evidence that they have low pain tolerance. They tend to catastrophize, that are less kind, and that some suffering is needed to get through the world. But I don't think you need that much. And I think the idea that Nietzsche, the famous Nietzsche quote, what doesn't kill us makes us stronger, is one of the stupidest things a smart philosopher ever said. Because sometimes what doesn't kill us really messes us up. You know, it could give us PTSD, it could traumatize us, it could make us meaner and harder. I just think that life is full of suffering enough. And the claim that, oh, you all need more, I actually don't buy it. And I think there's part of it which is actually cruel, in a sense that if you tell me something bad has happened to you, I'm not sure I want to come back and say, such an opportunity for growth. You're so lucky this bad thing is happening. This will make you better. I think a more realistic response is to remind you that most people are really resilient. Most people are, resilience is the rules. PTSD, post-traumatic stress, or that's the exception. You will get over this. But I don't have to tell you, you better improve. Most people don't. Most people get over. Most people survive.
You also quote Shakespeare. You really do have such a wide range in the book, Paul. I've just gone from John Roberts to Shakespeare. You quote Shakespeare in your book. There is nothing either good or bad, but thinking makes it so. So you give that quote in the context of saying there's something even greater in terms of a greater truth about the good life. So tell me what that is.
I like that quote because it applies to many things. I think it particularly applies to what we were talking about before, about contrast and benign masochism. So, you know, imagine your heart is pounding. You can't breathe. You're soaked with sweat.
Sponsoring the show for this episode is Marquee TV. Marquee TV is a streaming service with a difference. It's bringing you the top tier of performing arts straight into your living room or onto your device. So think dance, theater, music, anything you might find in the West End, Broadway, or maybe a cool little experimental space too, but saving you the cost of a few tickets as well. I've got happily a bit lost in their vast library of performances, exclusive interviews, and behind-the-scenes content. Choreographer Jonathan Watkins' interpretation of George Orwell's classic 1984 was pretty cool, and I love the dance piece Sutra, inspired by the skills of Buddhist Shaolin monks. And we've got a special treat for our listeners. Marquee TV offers 3 months of access for just 99 cents. That's right, 3 months for only 99 cents with the code squared. Simply visit marquee.tv and use the promo code squared to dive into the world of arts like never before. Bring the arts home with Marquee TV. The events calendar is filling up here at Intelligence Squared, and to create each one, we obviously rely on some brilliant guests and onstage talent. But behind the scenes, there's also a producer, a production team, and the budget in the mix too. You've got to keep an eye on all of that stuff in one place. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform, slashing manual tasks and errors. And you can cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because it's super easy to get started. NetSuite exists in the cloud, you see, no hardware needed, so you're cutting IT costs too. That's why over 37,000 companies have already made the move. And now, by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/squared. That's netsuite.com/squared. netsuite.com/squared.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
Is that a good experience or a bad experience? Well, if it's happening to you right now, it'd be a bad experience. You'd say, oh, I'm having a heart attack. This is horrible. On the other hand, if you're finishing off a marathon, it could be a glorious experience. Suppose you're scared out of your wits. Well, is it because there's an intruder in your house? Or is it because you're in a haunted house having a good time? And so on and so forth. Our feelings, physical and emotional, aren't in themselves good or bad, but thinking makes them so. How we construe things makes a huge difference in our experiences.
Fascinating. In the acknowledgments, you thank someone for nearly persuading you that the whole idea of this book is deeply confused after you had finished writing it. Dare I ask what he said to nearly persuade you?
Yeah, this is my good friend,
your ex-friend?
Dan Gilbert. My ex-friend, whenever I talk about him, he doesn't want to be talked about. My good friend, and if you look at it, at my book, I cite his research more than anybody else. He does these brilliant studies, these clever, brilliant studies. And he is a hedonist. He thinks my motivational pluralism is silly. He thinks in the end, all there is pleasure, and all there's worth doing is maximizing pleasure. And it was, you know, I recommend everybody writing a book to get themselves a Dan Gilbert, some really smart person who thinks they're so wrong. And I wrestle with his ideas through the book. And, you know, obviously I'm not convinced. I think that the desire for meaning and the desire for pleasure, desire to be a good person, which we haven't spoken about, are genuinely different. They're different parts of the brain. They vary in different ways for different people. They compel us in different ways, and they clash with one another. But a smart hedonist will always argue, well, you think you try to make things fair because you care about fairness, but really what you want is the buzz that, you know, you get from doing a good thing, or the applause that people give you. Mm. And, you know, you read the book, I'm not convinced, but it's always good to have such a sharp critic by your side.
Indeed, you argue in the book that a life well lived is more than a life of pleasure. It involves moral goodness and meaningful pursuits, as well as other things. So just tell me more about it.
So in some way, this is not a psychological claim. It's a judgment claim. It's, you know, I can't say, oh, studies from my lab have shown you're making a big mistake. You're just trying to be happy. It doesn't work that way. It's fundamentally a moral claim about how we should live. And I'll tell you one more story, which was intended to illustrate this point. It's by the philosopher Robert Nozick. And Nozick imagines an experience machine. And now we're actually going back to the Matrix a bit, where they plug you into a machine, and for the rest of your life, you just lie on a bed, the rest of your natural life, and you have the experience of the best life ever, of success and love and purpose. Blah, blah, blah. But of course, it's just all a dream. It's just plugged in. And he asks, would you want to get plugged into the machine? And a lot of people, including him, including me, say no. And we say no because we don't just want to have the experience of doing things. We want to do things. We say no because we want to make the world a better place, not just think we made the world a better place. We say no because if we plug ourselves into the machine, we're abandoning everybody we love. And I couldn't bear to do it. Even though while I'm in the machine, of course, I never think of that. And to the extent you're pulled by this, to the extent you sort of say, yeah, those other things matter too, you're also a motivational pluralist.
So, Paul, before I turn to the question, I want to come back to your own experience of being in a flow state. So you talked about training for a marathon. You write in the book about learning to code. Tell me how you realized you wanted to spend more of your life in the state of flow and why it made you happier and more fulfilled.
Yeah, for me, the catalyst was reading Mihaly Csikszentmihalyi's book, Flow. And I read this late in my life, but it had this tremendous influence on me. And he describes flow, and sadly, he passed away a couple of weeks ago, actually, after this wonderful life. But he describes what a flow state is. And the best definition for me is a flow state is between, you're not bored, you're not anxious, you're in a sort of sweet spot, and you're so immersed, you lose track of time. You either forget to eat, you forget to pick up the kids, you're just totally lost in it. And in his book, he describes how trained athletes and dancers and musicians and artists and writers find themselves in flow states, sometimes for hours and hours at a time. Well, some people never get into flow states because it's difficult to get into flow state. It's a lot easier to watch TV or check your email or go on Twitter. But he made such a compelling case that, and I thought about it, and as I wrote this book, I thought about it more, that I'm trying to get more of that into my life and trying to shift away from things, oh, that'll be fun, that'll satisfy my immediate appetites, and think about things, is it the right level of difficulty that I could lose myself in it? And I think that sort of thing is extremely rewarding. You know, I'd like to people to buy my book. But if you only buy one book, I'd buy Flow. I think Flow's great.
Okay. You need to buy Paul's book. There's a tab on your screen.
Well, just use the tab to buy my book, but still. Then buy Flow.
And can never have too many books. But really, it's really a fantastic book and so many great stories and insights.
Thank you.
So I really do hope you pick up a copy of the book. And I'm going to now turn to audience questions. They're just coming in. I'll get to as many as I can. The first one is from Sarah, who asks, do you think we live in a society that tells us to avoid pain to our detriment? People often say kids are too protected from pain.
I think Sarah raises a good point. I mean, there are a lot of societies and they differ in all sorts of ways. But I think we tend to live in a society that kind of values hedonism and values pleasure and fun, maybe a bit too much. And one way this is manifested is in the biggest revolution in our lives, which has happened over the last 10, 20 years, which is social media and streaming services and so on, which is you go through your life with constant prodding of don't try, don't work, don't struggle, stick your face next to the screen and pass out. You know, watch a show, watch YouTube videos. And I'm sensitive to this because I'm very vulnerable to this. I can, I'm having problems sleeping and I pick up my phone and on Facebook and videos start showing up and an hour's gone by and I've just lost it. You know, the way I like to think about it is I think the CEO of Netflix once boasted that he wasn't competing with other streaming services. He's competing with sleep. And I think Facebook and Twitter and the like aren't competing with each other. They're competing with life. And they are offering you a simple, easy pleasure and highly incentivizing you to do it. And while, I don't want to sound like somebody's dad, but you should go outside and go for a run. You should lift some weights, read a Russian novel, have kids, do tough stuff. So yeah, I do think in some way there's a conspiracy against the right sort of suffering in our world.
Mm. The next questions come from Raul, who asks, what is the function of pain from a psychological perspective? I've heard it's to tell the brain there's something wrong. Is that accurate?
That is accurate. So pain serves a clear evolutionary purpose, which is it does. An animal, human, touches a cactus. It hurts like hell. The hand is throbbing in agony. And there's two things here. One is, because it was bad, you don't touch the cactus anymore. A critical learning experience. And also, now the hand is injured and it hurts. You keep it safe. You let it heal. Without pain, people would be lost. You might think pain is bad. And a lot of pain, as in chronic pain, is unnecessary. And we do it. And of course, there's an enormous industry trying to quell pains, which don't do us any good. But if you strip pain from somebody, they'd be in deep trouble. And we know that because there's unfortunate people who are born without the capacity to feel pain. And those people do very badly. They end up getting burnt and scarred. They don't treat their bodies properly. They don't protect limbs, right? Often they die quite young because of the number of injuries they sustain. So on the whole, Darwin makes it that pleasure is what draws you to what you should do. Pain pulls you away from what you shouldn't do. And my book is about exceptions. My book is about cases where pain is supposed to be bad, but it can be in the right circumstances good. But the evolutionary account given is, I think, precisely right.
Mm. Thank you. Next question is, one thing I've always wondered, is there a difference between happiness and fulfillment in your view?
People use the terms in all sorts of different ways. And so I'm not going to say, oh, absolutely. We've shown that there is, because it depends. You could use them that they mean the same thing. But maybe one way to answer this is I think there's very different notions that really worth keeping apart. And we could call one of them happiness, another one fulfillment. And happiness is basically how much fun you're having, how much pleasure you're having, you're lying in a nice swimming pool and it's sunny outside and you're kind of napping. And when you get up, you have a pina colada and I say, how you doing? I'm pretty happy, you say. But suppose you do this over and over again, and that's kind of your life. you might say, I'm pretty happy, but I'm not very fulfilled. I'm not very satisfied. I think happiness resonates more with the pleasure, fulfillment more with meaning and purpose. So you can be high in one and low in the other. You can also have, I was talking to a friend of mine last night, you can also have a life where you feel this is a valuable life, a purpose and meaning. Day to day, it kind of sucks. And, you know, I'm very interested in experience of raising children. And a lot of people with young children, really young children, or children with different disabilities, or teenagers, or I don't know, maybe old children, kind of find it hard. And are they happy? No, my kids are driving me nuts. I'd murder for a good night's sleep. You know, I wish I had some better childcare. I wish I, the house is so dirty, blah, 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 blah. But are you fulfilled? Yes. So you do get this difference.
Next question coming in, Paul. The question is, sometimes we know we should embrace some pain, but we're scared of being vulnerable. How do we overcome that? And asking for a friend was the last part of that question.
always asking for a friend. Well, everybody has a sort of level of pain and suffering that's acceptable. I like scary movies. Sometimes I'll scare the pants off me and I'll get a pleasure from it. But if they were too scary, it'd just be upsetting and really unpleasant. I got my level. You know, I kind of like to go for a good run sometimes. Would I run an Ironman triathlon? No, it'd kill me. You know, so I think it's not always a matter of saying, oh, you know, I'm a bit trepidatious, but I should jump in. How can you get us to jump in? Maybe you're reasonably cautious. I think people should sort of, there's a sort of know thyself thing here, which is that, particularly when it comes to all these pleasures, everything from scary movies to spicy foods to sadomasochistic sex, it's really good to know what your limits are. Everybody has different limits and different things they like. Even as something as simple as how hot do you want your bath? How spicy do you want your curry? And it's not a matter of, oh, just hit the maximum. I'm sure it'll work out. Some people it's too much. So I guess the idea would be, and I'm the cautious sort, is dip a toe in, try it, then try to ratchet things up. You know, I don't know. Try the 2-star chili before trying the 3-star chili and then see what you like. Find your sweet spot that way.
I think that's good advice when it comes to chilies in particular. The next question is from Tom in Derbyshire. Very interesting that the job market seems to be inverted in terms of meaning. Do you think this is something we can collectively change?
It's a really good question. And it actually, my answer is I don't know. I mean, what gets... The forces that cause some jobs to be prized and pay well are often very different from considerations of either the value of the job or the meaningfulness of the job and so on. In some way, it's not bad that meaningful jobs don't pay that well because they're meaningful. That's a good thing about it. You know, maybe you should give people a lot of money for jobs that are not meaningful because then they have the money and then they could get meaning some other way. There's the issue of jobs and meaning is very urgent these days. There's something in the United States they're calling the Great Resignation or the Great Quit. I don't know. Is it there as well?
It is, yes.
And, you know, a lot of people are not going back to work. And a lot of this is because, well, a lot of because people's jobs are unrewarding and unsatisfying. The sociologist David Graeber talks about bullshit jobs, which are jobs. And there's sort of middle management jobs. Which just, they're doing nothing. You're just shuffling papers around. It's not even that they're terrible. They just provide no meaning because they have no impact on the world. And so if we could work to eliminate jobs that do no good, if we could work to properly, you know, make rewarding jobs that are needed and fix up some really gross imbalances in what people are paid for. I think that would be a good thing. I also think, by the way, that sometimes people get jobs wrong. And what they think is, oh, the job I want should be easy, well-paid, high status, and easy. But it's a recipe for boredom. I think the idea of going for challenging jobs and jobs that push you is really valuable. And I'll end on a kind of a Zen thing, which is there's a Zen idea that any activity, any job could be made meaningful in the hands of the right person. Cleaning toilets, washing dishes and everything can be given meaning. And I've seen this. I've seen people do jobs which other people view as menial, and they think this is important. And they seek out the importance in it. And I've also seen the flip side. I'm a tenured professor, and I think this job is just full of immense possibilities and opportunities. But in the last 2 years, I've had three friends quit, tenured people at top universities quit. And they say, this isn't doing anything for me. I'm deeply unsatisfied, and I want to do something else. So, people are different in how they respond to different circumstances.
The next question starts off with thanks. Thanks, Paul. A great talk. The question is, how do we know that chosen suffering is going to lead to long-term pleasure?
We know it not so much from sort of specific laboratory studies or experiments, but from observing the activities that people themselves engage in. So we know, for instance, that there's a pleasure and a satisfaction to sustained effort. And, everything from doing crossword puzzles. I like doing crossword puzzles. And I like the idea that I'm sort of struggling with crossword puzzles that I do it, all the way to running marathons, to triathlons, to writing books, to opening a business, that people will tell you that what matters the most to them are things that involve struggle and difficulty. So it's something we see not so much in experimental laboratories, but played out in the real world. I mean, to put it another way, if you went up to somebody and said, what gives you the most satisfaction and pleasure and joy? It's very likely it'll answer you with something that involves difficulty and work and struggle.
So the next question is, do you have any thoughts on drugs that induce pleasure, like MDMA? Do you think these would be valuable to be explored more?
Yeah, I'm enough of a motivational pleasure thing. Pleasure is good. MDMA is good. A nice whiskey. I'm in Toronto now, where marijuana is legalized, and it seems the whole city is in a cloud of pot. And I think these things are good as far as it goes. If they are indulged in enough, so much that they rob you of everything else in life, and there's sort of a cliche of the stoner on the sofa who the rest of his life he's just smoking pot and getting high, then I think it's tragic. But drugs that give you pleasure, as long as they have the right place in your life, and putting aside any other side effects they have, that's all to the good. There's nothing wrong with being happy. And then you also get to the case where, and this, I don't know if this wasn't a question, but you get to antidepressants and drugs that are done to deal with clinical conditions. And there I think that they're very valuable. I don't think people find it very hard to do even meaningful, difficult things when they're depressed or anxious. So taking the drugs to pull you out and make you a more full person, I think, has tremendous value.
The next question, Paul. There is a big mental health crisis among young men right now. Why do you think that is?
There are actually several different mental health crises among different people. My answer to everything regarding mental health for the last 2 years is COVID. So the pandemic has had caused terrible disruptions and terrible effects on depression and anxiety. There's a lot of debate over the extent to this and where it happens and who it happens to. But COVID has definitely taken its toll. There are other factors in the United States, but I'm not sure elsewhere. There are what Angus Deaton calls deaths of despair. And these are actually tend to be localized in men, but not young men, men in their 50s and a bit older, who seem to have an epidemic of suicide. A lot of it is related to opioid addiction. And then there's the general fact, and this is not recent. This has probably been a problem for as long as there's been people. But young people often struggle with meaning and a lack of fulfillment. And I want to be sort of cautious here, because I don't think the evidence is strong. This is just speculation. But I think for a lot of young people, and maybe young men, they feel kind of at a loss. They feel they might have some degree of material wealth, particularly in a good society, has some sort of welfare system, but their lives lack meaning. And, the solution to this, one solution of this, is to pick up a cause, hopefully a good cause, and these things give meaning. I quote early in the book, Greta Thunberg, the young climate activist. She had this tweet and said, basically, I can't remember it off by heart, but basically she said, I was just miserable at home doing nothing without anything. And then I discovered this cause and it infused my life with meaning. And now I am transformed. And that is very, very typical.
So the penultimate question for you is, are you someone who subscribes to the idea that the decline of religion has led to people losing meaning in their lives? And Sarah asked that.
Yes. I'll say this, saying that just before people think, whoa, where am I coming from? That I'm a secular atheist. I don't believe any of this stuff, but I'm very interested in religion. And religion is plainly a source of meaning for many people. And this brings us back to unchosen suffering, where as a secular atheist, if something bad happens to me, I just, that's bad. Something bad happened to me. Somebody I love dies, I lose my job, my house burns down. That just is. But religion provides narratives. And I might say, well, God was testing me. Or everything happens for a reason. I'm sure this will come out better in the end. And religion provides a lot of narratives to fill your life with meaning. And I think that could have a huge benefit for many people. I mean, I said before that poor countries, people have lives of less meaning, of more meaning than rich countries. One reason for this is poor countries are more religious than rich countries. So yeah, there's a lot to that claim.
Mm. And then the final question, Paul, going back to fear of pain, i.e. not risking for fear of pain, there are many people who are incapable of loving out of fear of getting hurt. What then, aside from a good psychologist, would be your answer to that?
My answer is a good psychologist. I mean, and there's all sorts of reasons why people are leery of relationships. And to some extent, it connects to what we're talking about here, which is meaning. I talked about having kids, but actually romantic relationships are a really good example of what is an end, a meaningful and I think hard pursuit. You know, one night stands, flirting, the initial spark of a relationship could be nothing but pleasure and joy. But sustaining a relationship is fraught with risk and disappointment and struggle. You know, nobody who's been in a relationship with somebody for a year has always had good times with them. And I'm not saying anything new here, that this is one of the most important pursuits we could have. There's a line from Sigmund Freud. He's asked, what's the value? Now, it turns out he didn't actually say this, but it's a good line. He says, love and work. A healthy mind has solved the problems of love and work, where work refers to a lot of what we're talking here, sustained activity and difficult projects. And love is relationships with your kids, with your brothers and sisters, your friends, and with romantic partners. And whoever wrote that, I mean, I don't have any more to say than finding good person to talk with, to work you through this and get you prepared to go on that next step is indispensable and really important.
Mm. It's been absolutely fantastic, Paul. Before we let you go, what would you like our audience to take away from your work on the sweet spot? What are the kinds of things you want them to go away and to think about? Perhaps they could dive into your debate with the hedonists.
Yes. I guess a couple of things. One thing would be to sort of think a little bit about the role of pain and suffering and difficulty and effort in a life well lived. Maybe ask yourself if you haven't chosen any of these things, maybe you should give them a shot. And, you know, the book has a lot of stories and examples of this. And then the other one is more theoretical, actually. I'm a research psychologist. It's nice to try to help people and give advice, and I don't resist the temptation, but I'm really interested in how the mind works. And to take seriously the idea that humans are complicated, that we are very quick to denigrate ourselves. Say, oh, all we want is pleasure. All we want is get pleasure, avoid pain. Simple as that. But it's not. It's much richer. It's the religious people have it more right than a lot of my psychologist colleagues. We want many things. We want pleasure, sure. But we also want meaning. We want morality. Sometimes we want truth. Sometimes we want beauty. It's a lot of things. Life is interesting. So that's it.
Great, great takeaways. And your book is absolutely fascinating.
Thank you so much.
I mean, we talked about a lot of concepts, but there's so much more in the book, especially around stories and details and studies. I mean, pain, happiness, meaning. I'm astounded at how much ground you've actually covered. And also, I would just tell the audience, you can buy the book using the tab on your screen. It's very accessibly written and a real pleasure to read. So a huge thanks to Paul Bloom for spending the time with us to share the insights from his book. And it's been just an absolutely fascinating hour. So again, please go buy his book, The Sweet Spot. I urge you all to pick up a copy. You won't regret it. And with that, I'm going to thank you all for joining us for this Intelligence Squared Plus event.